Welcome to the Impact Equals podcast, in which we explore and demystify the impact investment industry. In this series, we will ask some of the architects of the industry why impact investment matters and how it is playing a key role in meeting some of the largest challenges facing the world today. My name is Andrew Murray Watson. Faheen Alaboy is the Managing Director of JP Morgan Development Finance Institution. Prior to joining JP Morgan, she spent 18 years at the International Finance Corporation, the private sector arm of the World Bank, where she was responsible for setting strategy, business development, transaction execution, and portfolio management. Her role at JP Morgan's DFI is to funnel private capital into economic development in emerging markets in support of the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And it's worth noting at this point that the funding gap to meet those Sustainable Development Goals is somewhere in the region of $4 trillion. And to stand the slightest chance of bridging this gap, the world needs a great many global private investors to step up to the plate. Faheen, firstly, welcome to the Impact Equals podcast. It's a great pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can I start by asking about, I guess, the nuts and bolts of what JP Morgan is doing in the DFI space since it launched 3 years ago? What are the bank's ambitions for the business, and have they changed since it was launched?
So the JPM DFI was created in 2020 in an effort to achieve three objectives. First was to scale JP Morgan's business in the emerging markets. JP Morgan is a large global firm with a deep presence and history in many emerging markets. We have a large global footprint, and we are very motivated to focus on the economies of the future to help them access finance for their healthcare, infrastructure, financial services, and other such growth needs. The second objective really was to spur additional capital towards the Sustainable Development Goals. I think there are two large global agenda that the world is coalescing around. One are the UN Sustainable Development Goals. The other are the Paris Climate Accords, both of which have 2030 targets. And I think that the rubric of sustainable development was very important at JP Morgan. And that was a second motivator to setting up the DFI. And then the third, which is commercial in nature, is that we have two sets of clients. We have clients that raise money on one hand, and then we have investor and institutional clients on the other that fund those projects. And we were seeing a clear and keen demand from institutional capital to do more in ESG and impact. And we thought it was important to serve that need. We also have deep relationships with many multilateral development banks and DFIs that are keen to partner with the private sector. And so we thought that this could be another good way to partner with these institutions to bring private capital to bridge the important development gaps that you mentioned, Andrew.
And just on a personal level, what attracted you to the role? I mean, you'd been in the IFC for a very long time. I mean, 18 years. What prompted the move?
I think it was a really interesting opportunity to see a large global investment bank wanting to come into this space and to give importance to development and to emerging economies. In essence, it really allowed me to marry my career in finance and in development with a keen objective in doing more in emerging markets.
I think it's reasonable to say that a great many people are looking at JP Morgan as perhaps providing a route for other private investors to get into the development space. I mean, is that a fair representation?
I think the role that JP Morgan and other banks can play is actually as an intermediary. Our role is an intermediary. And as I said earlier, we have clients who want to raise money, be it in the debt space or in equity. And then we have relationships with investors that are keen or interested to come into those deals. And so I think what we can do as an intermediary is help our clients tell a better impact story to those institutional investors. And for us to engage with institutional capital that's there to understand what they're looking for, what geographies they may be interested, what sectors, and what kind of transactions they're keen to come into. So I think the role that we can really play is really to bring those parties together, because institutional capital is what is really need to be mobilized to achieve the numbers that you've mentioned.
And we've talked about ecosystems and where JP Morgan fits into those ecosystems and kind of development space. But I'm assuming that JP Morgan has a huge ecosystem of itself. So internally, has part of the initial phase of the job been one of education in terms of communicating with your colleagues within the bank?
Absolutely. I think that the beauty of a large organization, a large global institution like JP Morgan, is that there's so many different groups that are keen to work in this space. So I think on one side, you have people who work in relationship management, in engagement with clients to understand what are clients looking to do? Where are they trying to raise funds? What products are they trying to engage in? So those are one set of people that we definitely spoke to understand the trends and the opportunities. The other set of people at JP Morgan, obviously, within this, within what we call the CIB or the Corporate and Investment Bank, are those with product expertise. So these are people in with expertise in export finance or in debt capital markets or equity capital markets or in hedging or swaps. And to really understand, is that transaction doable, right? Will the client be able to access the market at the best possible time to get the best possible execution terms? And so being able to work with both those parties internally was incredibly helpful. A third part of it was the fact that we have a very large global footprint, as I mentioned, and I was incredibly pleased to be able to put in a call or a Zoom call to colleagues in Jakarta or Joburg or Hanoi or Bogota and get a lot of local color and knowledge as to what's happening in terms of regulatory trends or needs domestically in these markets, or what our ability is as a firm to operate in this geography. So I think bringing all of these different things to bear, that ecosystem you talk about, was definitely a big part of how we launched.
Mobilization is obviously a key area of focus for you. Can you talk about how your DFI identifies sources of capital?
Our main conduit of bringing money to transactions is through the institutional investor base that we're connected to. But it's also really interesting to partner with the MDBs and DFIs and other players such as export credit agencies to make transactions more palatable to a broader set of institutional investors. I think we work directly with the MDBs and DFIs and also the ECAs in several ways. We've worked with them where they've come in as anchor investors in our transactions, or have provided guarantees in those transactions to attract additional capital. I think a nice example was Port Bolivar in Ecuador, which is the expansion of a state-of-the-art port on the Pacific coast that is the conduit of a lot of Ecuador's agricultural products to the market. And we have the nice example of having done a first deal where BPI of France came in as an export credit agency, and a follow-on transaction where the US DFC came into the deal as well. We've also had the opportunity to work on several transactions where the MDBs and DFIs have come in as anchor investors. These include transactions such as Liquid Telecom and Georgia Global Utilities. And one from last year is Axian Telecom, which is a Pan-African provider of high-speed fiber connectivity. They are moving many of their clients from 4 to 5G services, building out additional tower infrastructure and increasing subscribership in rural areas. And we worked with Axian on their debut bond to articulate the fact that they are helping their customers and clients through mobile money payments and job creation and skill building, and also through the company's foundation that supports primary schools in Togo. And this transaction, which was a debut one, as I mentioned, also had the benefit of several DFIs, including the likes of DG and IFC and BII, coming in to anchor the deal and to show that confidence of the institutional market when the deal went to the capital markets.
So as part of the Impact Equals campaign, we're looking at what true impact means. And more players enter the sector, there are more and more definitions of what impact is and what that means to the operating models of the players within it. So what does impact mean to you personally and also for JP Morgan?
For us at JP Morgan, impact is really about the intentional focus on advancing development priorities through credible impact metrics, KPI setting, and reporting. It's also about mobilizing private and public capital to address the SDGs. For us, the core of our work is really our impact methodology, which we use to help our clients establish industry-specific metrics that they can then report on. Impact, I think, also means partnering. the DFIs and MDBs to bring some of their mobilization tools to bear, or working directly with EMs, institutional capital, that have pockets for ESG and impact, and harnessing that partnership to create better outcomes.
Where do you balance the impact versus returns? Do you have an internal benchmark in terms of the returns that you're looking for? Does the DFI play a kind of catalytic capital role for the rest of the bank? How do you weigh up impact against return?
So we don't look at that trade-off. What we have done in our team is really to enhance the client's ability to tell an impact narrative, to help them during the due diligence process, being able to articulate to investors what impact they're having on their domestic economy, on sector-specific objectives, be it financial inclusion, or more corporate objectives such as job creation or improving gender ratios at their firm. And by so doing, helping investor demand into those transactions. We are an intermediary that wants to make our clients have the best opportunity for market access and execution, and also the best access to high quality investors. So that's really the role that we play.
And from your perspective, what is the changing appetite for impact investment amongst the institutions that you're talking to?
I like the way you said it earlier, which is there's an ecosystem change. I think it's coming from all parties. So companies themselves, or governments, or state-owned entities, all realize that they have an opportunity and potentially a responsibility to tell the markets and their stakeholders and shareholders more about what they're doing beyond their financial progress. And so I think you have that happening at the same time as the investors who are coming in. These can be private equity firms, they can be large institutional investors, all wanting to show their capital providers that they're doing a better job at aggregating and selecting clients based on impact. So this is kind of a virtuous cycle where different actors in the industry are all kind of moving in the same direction and trying to tell a better impact narrative as well as a financial narrative that they've been so accustomed to telling.
To meet the SDGs, the sums we're talking about are so huge that private finance has to be responsible for the vast percentage of the capital required to meet those SDGs. Obviously, private investment into impact funds is increasing. Is it increasing fast enough? I mean, we need to see exponential growth. What's your view in terms of how fast that acceleration is taking place?
So the one point I would make is that a lot of the funding needed to achieve the gaps to achieve the SDGs are actually coming from national sources, right, as well. They're coming from governments, they're coming from companies operating in those countries, and creating economic growth and the local drivers are there as well, beyond just foreign investment or the MDBs. But I do think, of course, private capital plays that role already in many, many transactions, right? I mean, we live in such an interconnected world. People are constantly investing, not only just in new projects, but I think what's very important is that they're operating businesses all across the emerging markets that are either locally owned, joint ventures, or have foreign investors. And those continue to be invested in and operated in a more efficient way and to maintain and sustain the jobs and the industry that is there.
I mean, COVID and then Ukraine and the kind of headwinds in the global economy. Do you think those have actually thrown into sharper perspective the need for impact investment? Is there now a sort of a greater awareness and acceptance that impact investment in emerging economies particularly has a profoundly more important role to play than perhaps was recognized pre-pandemic?
I would say that the trend was already there. I think the focus on, be it ESG or impact, had already started taking root. Obviously, the development banks and others in government, for example, have been working on this project for decades. And so institutional capital had been moving towards it. And maybe some of these headwinds have accelerated the focus on it. I think the focus on climate has also been helpful, making us realize how we articulate and how we mitigate environmental impact of what we do. So I do think there's a sharper focus, but it's within a continuum of something that had already started and I hope will continue just as a sense of urgency around all these issues increase.
How far away in that case from impact investment becoming just investment? Like, I mean, you know, when does it stop becoming an alternative asset class? When does it start becoming normal?
I would hope that this mainstreaming you're talking about will come about sooner, because I feel all such movements and trends have accelerated. I think if you look at the numbers today, there are about 35 trillion assets out there for ESG. This is both for emerging markets and developed markets. And about 1.5 trillion of it has a more explicit impact focus. And I can see both that bigger number growing and then the impact part of that pie also growing.
There seems to be a kind of a growing pushback against the value of ESG. Why do you think that is?
I think that's where impact has a huge potential, because what it's really there to show is where are we today and what impacts do we want to have going forward? And I think that the opportunity you have is to really be more explicit and intentional from day one on what your targets are, and to be able to disclose to investors and to stakeholders or whoever the audience may be, did you achieve them and why not, right? Because not everything is linear, as we discussed earlier. And I think that explicit disclosure is a real strength of the impact space within the broader context of ESG. And I think that it's nice in the maturation of these type of industries that people want to get away sometimes from just a label, but to come down to the specifics and come in to say, how does it really impact this industry? How does it work within this geography? What is the problem that we're trying to solve? Really get down to the next order of details, both the forward-looking intentions and then the milestones along the way on how a company or a country may be doing in that progress.
So do you think then the impact investment is just a natural successor to ESG? I mean, is it just going to replace ESG for the reasons you've just articulated?
I think it will be a growing overlay on ESG. And I think that it's important to understand that as all spaces, as they grow and develop, will become a little bit more nuanced. And I think that's what we're really moving towards. And there will be evolutions and changes on what even ESG means. And even in climate, which is really focused today on mitigation and on carbon reduction, which is incredibly important to the world, is now expanding to focus a lot more on adaptation, on water, on agriculture, on nature. So I think these are all natural evolutions that will happen. And sometimes it's not obvious what the outcomes will be, but this is a trend I think that is here to stay and hopefully, as we discussed, become more and more mainstream.
You mentioned climate and specifically mitigation, and there's more and more attention being paid to mitigation and adaptation. Certainly at the last COP in Egypt, there was a great deal of talk and attention given to it. What's the role of DFIs in adaptation and resilience?
I think the MDBs and DFIs are really well placed when it comes to adaptation. I think, number one, they have long-standing client relationships and really know how to help them navigate potential climate constraints and issues, how it affects their businesses and local economies. Number two, they have strong local footprints, right? And so that ability to engage domestically with companies, but also national authorities are trying to push an industry-wide agenda together. So for example, if there is coffee growers that are going to deal with certain diseases or the fact that the temperature is warming and they have to really move their coffee plantations to another area or what have you, that's something that the MDBs and DFIs have a lot of visibility on or could have impact because of their on-the-ground presence, their ability to speak with both governments and with companies. And I think the last thing that comes as a strong advantage is obviously technical advisory. The fact that that capacity exists to have long-term engagements with governments and countries to bring that advisory and that technical expertise to communities, to industry associations, or even help change national laws or policy. Is a really important role that the MDBs and DFIs play.
So just one final question, and we were asking all the guests on the show the same question. What are the sort of the greatest trends that will shape the impact investment industry over the next few years that you're seeing?
I think that the biggest trends are going to be technology. This could be everything from telecommunications to financial inclusion. The fintech space has grown, and to do things a lot more sustainably, right? We have the opportunity, especially in emerging markets, to leapfrog. We can build infrastructure in better ways, more climate resilient ways. And I think that that opportunity that technology presents, it could be in education, it could be in AI, is really an interesting one and a trend that's here to stay. And I think the second is really, as we discussed earlier, the fact that we are able to think of climate more broadly. We can think of its impact on agriculture, on water, on nature. The adaptation focus has changed as well. And so I think that's another trend that we're going to continue to see, is to see that broadening definition of climate and how the change in climate will impact livelihoods and communities, and also transnational issues that arise thereof. So I think those are two trends and opportunities of the future.
That's great. Fahima, thank you very much for your time. It's been a great pleasure speaking to you. And thank you to all our listeners.